From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. President Trump makes his UN debut.
I will always put America first. Just like you, as the leaders of your countries, will always and should always put your countries first.
What does that mean for international cooperation on major challenges like North Korea? Also today, an inside look into why Border Patrol agents are setting up checkpoints on New England highways.
And we're here because we feel this is the best use of our resources to try to combat the threat that is facing our country.
Plus, more bad news about tackle football and kids' brains.
The more hits kids got, youth football, the greater the change in the structures of their brain over just one season of play.
That's next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's start today with President Trump's debut at the United Nations General Assembly. The president was at turns conciliatory to the international body and at turns critical. He was also unyielding in his threats against North Korea and its pursuit of nuclear weapons.
No nation on earth has an interest in seeing this band of criminals arm itself with nuclear weapons and missiles. The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
Well, joining us now with some analysis is Adil Najam. He's dean of the Frederick Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University. Dean Najam, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So your first thoughts on the president's bellicose portions of his speech regarding North Korea. Totally destroy North Korea if necessary, the president says. Your reaction?
I don't think there was a surprise there. There would have been a surprise if he hadn't been him. There is this sort of the language of a schoolyard brawl that goes between North Korea and the U.S. at the highest level. So in that, there wasn't a surprise. I think the bigger surprise was probably Iran and Venezuela and the language he used for them. North Korea was clearly on his agenda, and he has used that type of language before.
So, I mean, we'll get to Iran and Venezuela in a moment, but I have to say, was there some diplomatic decorum that the president gleefully broke there by
Rocket Man,
right? I mean, the president of North Korea, the leader of North Korea, has a name, but I get the whole Rocket Man nickname from President Trump is certainly going to appeal to his base. But how are members of the UN likely to react to that?
I think they've gotten used to our president by now. They would have been surprised if he hadn't thrown in something like that. Plus, it'll give, 1,000 headlines around the world, and radio stations would be playing it all the time. So in some ways, the presidential decorum has been changed. And the world expects it now from this president, and the U.S. certainly expects it. So it's kind of, we are slowly becoming the new normal. I think the real story is that he didn't break it as much as many people had feared he might. He didn't go to the extent, for example, that he had gone during the campaign, when he was calling the United Nations the enemy of democracy and bad for the United States and so on and so forth. So in some ways, he appeased every base. His people, his core support, he said, send the right message to him, make America great again, mentioned sovereignty, mentioned, the tough image. But folks in the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General, would probably be pleased that he didn't go to the extent that he could have and has in the past. Many countries would also be pleased that he didn't go as anti-global ballistic as they had feared. So in that sense, there was, in an odd way, a balance as far as Mr. Trump's rhetoric is concerned.
Okay, so I was seeing that some diplomatic observers or analysts were saying that in a way the president also sort of redefined what his version of the axis of evil would be. That North Korea, obviously, on there. You mentioned Iran, and so here's what Donald Trump said about Iran today.
It is far past time for the nations of the world to confront another reckless regime, one that speaks openly of mass murder, vowing death to America, destruction to Israel, and ruin for many leaders and nations in this room. The Iranian government masks a corrupt dictatorship behind the false guise of a democracy.
Now, the United States, over the past many administrations, has been unrelentingly critical of Iran. So what's different about this?
I think the timing is important. So North Korea was very, very strong, uncharacteristic for the United Nations, but not a surprise. The surprise in Iran is the timing. Next month, the U.S. president has to either accept or not accept the nuclear agreement that the U.S. had also signed with Iran. And we should remember, it is not, many people forget, it is not a U.S.-Iran agreement.
Right. Right. But the president speaks as if it is.
As if it's just his, right?
Yeah.
So there was Germany and there was Britain and there was Russia and there's China, all of whom signed on it. So this type of language coming right before he has to sign it means one of two things given who's saying it. One is this is his way of, you know, upping the pressure. This is a negotiation tactic. You need to do more before I would say yes. Or the other, and I think the second one is more likely, he's showing his hand. He, after this sort of language, how does he go and sign an agreement that he has had these things to say about? So this might have been the surprise tweet inside the speech.
Well, but circling back to North Korea then, if, let's say, the president is signaling that he's not going to recertify the Iran deal, if you're in Pyongyang, what motivation do you have whatsoever, not that there are serious talks going on, to trust that the United States would come to a good faith agreement with you on your...
Oh, no, they don't. I mean, they don't. But they don't expect that either. I think Pyongyang has a big smile on their face. You know, when I said he pleased everyone, that includes Pyongyang, because I think they are on a mission, their leader is on the mission, to sort of poke Mr. Trump and get him to say these things. I don't think they are looking for a good faith agreement either. The interesting thing and the disturbing thing for us, I think, is in some ways what I was surprised was how much of the speech was about people who the U.S. perceives to be its enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And all around the world, he was seeing these enemies. Usually this sort of setting and this sort of place, you do a bit of that.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is this uplifting thing. We are going to, George Bush goes and say, we're going to deal with AIDS in Africa, poverty, and so on and so forth. So there was much more victimhood. And this was a speech that sounded like a weak country rather than a superpower.
Okay, so to that point, let's play another portion of the president's speech. This was one that I personally found very, very interesting. He talked about sovereignty and American sovereignty. He mentioned the word sovereignty 19 times in his speech, and here's one example.
In foreign affairs, we are renewing this founding principle of sovereignty. Our government's first duty is to its people, to our citizens, to serve their needs, to ensure their safety, to preserve their rights, and to defend their values. As President of the United States, I will always put America first. Just like you, as the leaders of your countries, will always and should always put your countries first.
Now,
and he gets an applause.
Yeah, he does.
Yes.
And it's, at first it seemed a little hesitant, but he got some applause. And so that's why I read that portion two ways. One is where the president is affirming the importance of the nation state, that in order for, you know,
this global, is the realist in him.
Yeah, if civilization to persist and to flourish, nation states are the way to do it. But on the other hand, when he's telling everybody at the United Nations, put the interests of your country first, how does that augur for international cooperation?
I'm so glad you brought this up, because I also found this the most interesting thing. He also snuck in, if you noted, this little short little seminar on socialism in there.
Right.
Right. So the professor of international relations in me kind of had a big smile there. This is probably the most intellectual, if you will, or conceptual or academic that Mr. Trump has ever been. As you said, 19 times you said sovereignty. I think this is important. First of all, sovereignty the U.S. has played always, every country does in the U.N. But in the U.N. in these settings, sovereignty is a word that is usually used by countries whose self-perception is weakness, vulnerability, and victimhood. So Cuba would use it a lot. Saudi Arabia would use it. You know, you can't make us follow your norms of human rights or women rights because we are a sovereign nation. That's the type of context sovereignty is often talked about in this type of UN. So I've spent my life in these UN places, and sovereignty is a word that a particular type of country uses in this sort of setting. And so that's, I think, what the applause was partly for, because it was such a surprise coming from the U.S. The U.S. is usually the one saying, we must rise to our great global heights,
right.
You know, to our better self, to higher order. So I think that was a very, very major thing that happened. Second, sovereignty is important because I think he's coined a new terms for his followership. He did actually something conceptually quite interesting here. He gave a meaning to make America great again in the global context, right? So the big question was, how does Mr. Make America Great Again go to the world, which he has been saying is kind of the enemy, right? Globalists are bad.
Right.
And go into the enemy's nest and come back. So sovereignty was his way of doing that. He was saying, I will make America great again because I really care about my sovereignty, and you do too.
Yeah.
Right? So this is a very different rhetoric from, I think, everyone from Frederick Roosevelt onward in the global debate.
You know, and to add to that, what's interesting to me is that, again, it's sort of like the Trump administration speaking with a somewhat fractured voice, because on the other hand, Nikki Haley, as ambassador to the United Nations, has shown great American leadership through, you know, helping push through the new round of sanctions against North Korea and the Security Council. So still believing in the effectiveness of, to some degree, of the United Nations being a global player to deal with these international problems.
And in a way, you know, he's doing that. You're seeing in his foreign policy, he's calling on a lot of countries to help the U.S. reach some of our foreign policy goals, right? So North Korea has to be reined in by China.
Yeah.
Iraq, Russia has to go in, not Iraq, Syria, right, and do more on, and so on and so forth. So I think, you know, part of it is just time is making Mr. Trump realize that you do need the global thing, but he's doing it in a very different way.
He's doing it in a very Trump way.
In a very Trump way?
I mean, he told some nations at the UN today that, in fact, some nations are going to hell. And Samantha Power, former UN, American UN ambassador, tweeted, telling countries they are going to hell at the UN General Assembly is generally not the most effective way to get them to do what you want them to do. So another view there. Adil Najam is dean of the Frederick Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. United States Customs and Border Patrol can set up immigration checkpoints anywhere within 100 miles of a U.S. land or sea border. 100 miles. And if you think about that for a moment, you come to the startling realization that that area includes most of New England. Which is why, a couple of weeks ago, Border Patrol agents set up a temporary checkpoint near Woodstock, New Hampshire, right on I-93, 70 miles away from the Canadian border. 25 people were arrested for alleged immigration violations, several more for alleged drug possession. And what's more interesting, this was the first time such a checkpoint had been set up in New Hampshire in 5 years. So why now? And why there? And exactly what legal authority do Border Patrol agents have at these checkpoints? And what are your legal rights? Well, Bradley Curtis is the Division Chief for Customs and Border Protection in Swanton, Vermont, which covers New Hampshire, Vermont, and upstate New York, and he joins us now with some insight. Bradley Curtis, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So, first of all, I wonder if you could just define to us, how does CBP define what the 100-mile boundary is? I mean, especially in New England where you're working.
That has to do with our Board and Search Authority, and that's from the International Border, and that's what the law says within a reasonable boundary, and the courts have declared that, for the most part, 100 miles is a reasonable boundary. So we go by that 100 miles from the international border.
Okay. Tell me a little bit more about why setting up immigration checkpoints within that boundary is important for CBP.
Sure. So I think what a lot of people think is that, okay, well, you know, we're not at the border. Why are you guys here? Now, what folks have to understand is, so in our sector, we cover 295 miles of international border. And in that area, we have a little more than 300 Border Patrol agents. Even if everybody was working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you're still, the math would work out to about a mile per agent. It would be physically impossible for our agents to operate within 10 feet of the border area and do their job. So we have a lot of different operational strategies that we use, but we have to monitor some of the routes of egress and stuff like that. So the transnational criminal organizations that are involved, and we're not always necessarily going to catch them right at the border, right on the slash. We have to work it smarter, and sometimes this does include setting up immigration checkpoints away from the border area, and we do a lot of studies, et cetera, to determine where these best locations are.
Okay. You mentioned the transnational criminal organizations that you're trying to catch here. I take your point that it's not going to always be possible to get them right at the border, but away from the border, why wouldn't that be the purview of state or local law enforcement, or even federal law enforcement that's not Customs and Border Protection?
We're kind of like, lack of a better term, a transit area. So they're going from a city in Canada to Boston, to New York City, down along the eastern seaboard. So they're not necessarily coming here to reside in upstate Vermont, upstate New York, upstate New Hampshire. I mean, that does happen to a degree, but for the most part, what we're focusing on is, okay, if these organizations are trying to smuggle individuals into the country and they're going from one city to the other, what is the most efficient way, given what resources we have, to try and disrupt these organizations from successfully smuggling people into the United States?
Okay, so then when a checkpoint is set up, walk us through exactly how it's set up and what happens when an agent approaches a vehicle at a checkpoint.
Essentially, when the vehicles pull up, Border Patrol agents on scene are questioning everybody as to their immigration status and whether or not they're a United States citizen. A lot of these quick investigative detentions are very quick once the person answers the questions, and then they're sent on their way. If there's any sort of discrepancy or question, then the vehicle will be referred to secondary for further investigation.
And how does the agent determine whether there's a discrepancy or additional questioning needed?
Well, without giving away all law enforcement tactics, I mean, we have extensive training on different things like how to review immigration documents. We have training on when people are being deceptive. There's a lot of different training that we receive, and generally they can make the determination rather quickly. And like I said before, if it's something that, okay, this person's questions aren't making sense or something's just questionable here, I've determined some, you know, reasonable suspicion, then they get referred to secondary for the initial investigation.
Mm-hmm. One question that a lot of folks might have, and definitely do have, is how in that moment do the agents ensure that they're not ending up racially profiling folks when they're trying to figure out who should go to secondary?
In 2004, DHS adopted the Department of Justice guidance regarding the use of race by a federal law enforcement agency. And basically what that is that affirms that DHS policy is against racial profiling. And along that same line, I mean, most of our agents started their careers on the southwest border. Because it borders with Mexico, the vast majority of our apprehensions were of subjects from Mexico. Up here, we're dealing with people from all over the world. So we put strict guidance out. We're not going to racial profile. We train our agents constantly and remind them constantly not to do this.
Right. You know, I have driven up and down that stretch. I mean, I'm thinking about the Woodstock checkpoint that was recently established. I've driven up and down that stretch of 93 dozens of times, and it's never once occurred to me that do I need to carry my U.S. passport with me? I mean, should people be carrying documentation? Because I think I always thought that in the United States, it was a country where you didn't have to have your papers with you all the time.
So those folks that are here on visitor visas or with a permanent resident card, et cetera, 8 U.S.C. 1304 little e talks about, you know, the requirement to carry documents. As far as U.S. citizens who are in the United States, yeah, you're not required to carry your passport. And if the driver pulls up and is able to clearly articulate to the agent on primary, yes, I'm a U.S. citizen, then the detention is very brief and the person sent on their way.
I see. Okay. Maybe you already answered this, but help me be sure I understand correctly. How much authority does CBP have to search cars, phones, luggage, etc.?
I mean, of course, we're bound by the Fourth Amendment, but each case is handled differently, and it would be kind of almost impossible for me to answer, you know, a general statement.
And are dogs used?
Yes. They're not there all the time, but we do have Border Patrol canines when available. Our canines are dual certified, meaning that they are trained to detect concealed humans, meaning maybe somebody's hiding in a trunk, maybe somebody's hiding in the backseat under a blanket. Additionally, they are also trained to detect narcotics.
So on that point, I mean, I'm sure you well know that there are civil liberties groups who are concerned about the fact that the dogs are dual trained, because the dogs are very good at what they do. I mean, I'm looking at a statement here from the ACLU of New Hampshire, and they say that the Supreme Court has upheld the use of immigration checkpoints, but only insofar as the stops consist of a brief and limited inquiry into residence status. Checkpoints cannot be used for, or primarily used, I should say, for drug search or general law enforcement efforts. And in practice, according to the ACLU, Border Patrol agents often do not limit themselves to brief immigration inquiries and regularly conduct criminal investigations and illegal searches at checkpoints. Again, that's from the ACLU of New Hampshire. I just wonder what your response is to that.
The Supreme Court case that upholds our immigration checkpoints is U.S. versus Martinez-Huerte. It's from 1976, and I believe that has been challenged numerous times. We do set up an immigration checkpoint. As far as when we encounter narcotics, that does happen, and the cases are mitigated appropriately. You mentioned the ACLU. I will not be able to discuss anything on that because I know there's pending litigation, so that's not anything that I can talk about on this call.
I see. Okay. Now, you know, you mentioned narcotics, but I wonder, for example, in Massachusetts, the voters voted to legalize marijuana, so it's legal under state law. If a checkpoint were to be set up here in Massachusetts, how would that work? Because in the Woodstock checkpoint up in New Hampshire, what was it? A couple of pounds of marijuana was also seized. So how would that work here in Massachusetts?
Yes, the different states throughout the country have their different laws, etc. However, we are a federal law enforcement entity, and for us, it's still a federal violation, so we will proceed accordingly. I can't speculate what would happen if we were set up in Massachusetts, because we've never set one up in Massachusetts, to my knowledge.
Yeah, I understand that you can't speculate, but am I off base in interpreting that since you are a federal, CPB is a federal organization, CBP, I should say, that they would have the authority to arrest people who possessed marijuana under federal law?
Yes.
Okay. So that's an interesting tension here in Massachusetts. So let's talk about the Woodstock checkpoint, because the one that happened up in New Hampshire on I-93 near Woodstock, I should say, wasn't exactly in Woodstock, New Hampshire. It was the first immigration checkpoint in New Hampshire anywhere in the state in 5 years. Tell me a little bit more about why Customs and Border Protection felt the need to set up that one.
We've always maintained the right to run our immigration checkpoints. It's part of our defense in depth strategy. We used to run them on a routine basis up there quite regularly, and a lot of this depends on, you know, what our operational needs are, what the intelligence is telling us, what our resources are. With all those different factors, the time was right to basically resume these checkpoint operations.
All right. You know, Mr. Curtis, I really appreciate the insight that you're providing us here, because obviously nationwide, there's a lot of attention being paid to how immigration enforcement is done in the United States right now. And I wonder, you've been doing this for 23 years, so you're a veteran with a lot of experience. Can you just reflect with me on, you know, how has the nature of your job changed, and if working at Customs and Border Protection now, does it feel any different than it has in years past?
Yeah, it's definitely. So I started my career in San Diego, California, in the mid-90s, and it was very busy. We had a lot of individuals crossing the border, and we were extremely busy. Back then, we didn't have quite the manpower. I think we were probably at about, if I had to guess, around 5,000 agents when I started, and we're currently at 20,000 plus. So the increase in manpower has been tremendous and much needed. I've been back on the northern border for 19 years now. I've seen quite a few changes as far as the changes in politics and stuff like that. That's not my job to comment on. You know, we just come to work every single day, you know, do everything we can to keep the nation safe.
Do Customs and Border Protection agents feel as if they have more support from the Trump administration than they've had in the past? I mean, I know you said you couldn't comment about politics, but forgive me, it's my job, so I'm going to ask you again. Is there a sense that perhaps their work is more valued or not? Has that any of that changed?
At the same time, so you say, maybe we were getting a little more support. I won't argue with that. At the same time, there's also a lot more scrutiny. And in the age of social media, we're scrutinized a lot more. So there's things that maybe we get, in my opinion, unfairly scrutinized for, but it's part of the job and we'll continue to drive on.
Yeah. Are we likely to see an increase in the number of checkpoints in New England or possibly even a permanent one?
The possibility of us being out there again is most likely we will be.
Okay. And finally, because I think a lot of people listening to this are going to say that, you know, they fully understand that the law permits checkpoints within that 100-mile boundary that we talked about. But there's also this feeling that, you know, no matter what the law says, it just feels strange to them and perhaps even kind of un-American to have border control checkpoints so deep inside the United States. And I just wonder, you know, what you'd say to those folks and about how they feel.
I understand that a lot of people maybe don't like being stopped or whatever. I completely understand that. However, we still have a extremely, extremely important job to accomplish, and it's all in the name of securing this great country that we all live in to continue with the American way.
Well, Bradley Curtis is the division chief for the U.S. Customs and Border Protection in Swanton, Vermont. He has worked at Customs and Border Protection for more than 23 years. Mr. Curtis, thank you so very much. I really appreciate your insights and your time.
Thank you. Have a great day.
So 100 miles within the United States, they can set up these border checkpoints, and they say that they are not a violation of Fourth Amendment rights. Let's get the view from an immigration attorney. Manchester-based Ron Abramson, he joins us now from New Hampshire Public Radio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Magna. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. So you heard what Bradley Curtis had to say. Do you have concerns about the fact that basically across most of New England, we could see these checkpoints and they would be legal?
To say I have concerns, I need to ask you how long the rest of this segment would be.
Seven and a half minutes.
I will try to distill my concerns. Of course, we have concerns. We have concerns about the way this is implemented and about the fact that even conceding the authority to set up a checkpoint and administer it for the purposes of detecting people who are not here in legal immigration status, there's a significant question about exceeding that scope, permissible constitutional scope.
So let's talk about that for a moment, because as you heard, Bradley Curtis said that the Supreme Court has upheld the questioning of immigration status, saying that that is not a violation of Fourth Amendment rights. First of all, do you agree or disagree with that? And then we'll get to the broadening of the scope in just a moment.
The authority comes from a regulation that was passed in the 50s at a time where we had about 1,100 Border Patrol agents, and now we're well in excess of 20,000, and that number may be outdated as well. We also look at the way the demographics in this country have shifted, and about two-thirds of the population live probably within that 100-mile area. So the genesis of this authority and the reality in which we live now are not necessarily matching up.
Mm. Well, so the other thing that Curtis said was that he said, yes, they use dogs, for example, dual-trained dogs. And this is where we get perhaps the potential broadening of scope, because even in that New Hampshire checkpoint from a couple of weeks ago, several dozen people were arrested on drug charges. This is where I think, is the legal question settled about whether or not Customs and Border Protection agents can do this? Because he said they are federal agents. They will detain people for breaking any kind of federal law, or at least drug law, that if they find them to do so.
Well, this gets into one of the questions you posed, which is sort of the interplay between different sovereigns and different jurisdictions. You have Customs and Border Protection with a very clear mission. And then if you read the media coverage, the local police basically saw an opportunity and turned this into a drug investigation that they admittedly, by their own statements, would not otherwise be authorized to do under New Hampshire law. So we had 25 alleged people here out of immigration status and another 45, 46 arrests for what were really small amounts of drugs, because when you say 2 pounds of marijuana were seized, that was over the course of dozens of arrests. So there's a little bit of conflation and there's a little bit of exaggeration as to the actual effects of this. I'm not aware of any implications that there were smuggling operations, that there were transnational criminal organizations at work. And, you know, you think El Paso, San Diego, Miami, Woodstock, New Hampshire, like the old kids book, one of these things is not like the other. So it seems that just because governmental agents have the authority to do something, that doesn't mean it's the most advisable decision to go ahead and do it, and certainly not necessarily in this way.
Hmm. I mean, what do you think is the root problem here, or the root challenge? Because Bradley Curtis insists, he asserted to us that, for example, in that the first couple questions that they ask, and they ask it of everybody who goes through the checkpoint, that they're not racially profiling, that they're very well trained, and that, you know, all you have to do is answer the questions honestly and you'll be on your way. So what's the problem here?
Well, one of the problems is that if the only tool in your toolbox is a hammer, the entire world starts to look like a nail. And right now we are in an era of heightened enforcement. We are seeing an erosion of sort of humanitarian discretion. We are treating everybody as if they are enemy occupiers, when the reality is that a lot of these people are longstanding members of our community.
Hmm. Do you have confidence, though? I mean, so let me just ask it more explicitly. Do you think that Border Patrol agents are racially profiling in order to make some conclusions about who to take to secondary questioning at these checkpoints?
I think it would be naive not to recognize that racial characteristics factor into these decisions, whether they are conscious, whether they are part of a policy, or whether they are all operating on a subconscious level and resulting in a disproportionate number of secondary inspections. The other number I haven't seen reported in the media is, what were the total number of vehicles stopped and detained? Hmm. What was the actual yield of this law enforcement operation, and what was the remedy for the inconvenience that untold motorists had to experience just so that we could apprehend 25 visa violators primarily and 46 people who may have been coming from states that have legal marijuana laws?
Yeah. So there's something else that Bradley Curtis said to us, which I found was really interesting. And that is that, you know, he sees his job as protecting the United States from the multiplicity of effects from transnational crime. And amongst those are human trafficking, drugs, etc. Now, of course, in terms of immigration, the focus has long been on the southern border. But when you take that broader view, why isn't the northern border any more important to protect? I mean, he's saying that it's just as important. So why not have these checkpoints in New England?
There's no disagreement on the principle or the premise of that suggestion. It's the fact that the numbers have always been, you know, significantly higher by exponential degree at the southern border. Mr. Curtis told you he started in San Diego and it was relentlessly busy. And the way the immigration courts and the checkpoints work on the southern border is very different from the way they work up here. So that's the main distinction.
Hmm. Well, it does seem as if we may see more of these checkpoints in New England. Bradley Curtis effectively said that. Is there likely or could there be legal battles around them?
Well, there will be certain challenges to the constitutionality of the search for the people who ended up arrested and charged on the state level. So, you know, New Hampshire law, even as recently as March of this year, the Supreme Court said that extending a stop for the purposes of bringing in a dog and using that to obtain consent from a motorist to search a vehicle is impermissible. It exceeds the constitutional authority in terms of our reasonable expectations of privacy in the state. But in terms of a challenge to the practice, that I will leave that in the capable hands of the ACLU.
Well, Ron Abramson is an immigration attorney based in Manchester, New Hampshire, joining us today from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Magna. My pleasure.
And you know, I already got a tweet from someone, Elaine Braun Keller, who said, "We got caught up in that roadblock on I-93. A guy in front of us in a pickup by himself got pulled over." If you were in that checkpoint, if you went through that checkpoint in New Hampshire a couple of weeks ago, send us a message. We're at radioboston.org or tweet me at Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Dr. Robert Stern is director of clinical research at Boston University's Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy Center. He studies how brains get damaged by repeated impacts to the head, specifically in football players. And he's studied the brains of NFL players and college and high school athletes. And today, Stern is out with a new study on what happens to the brains of people who played tackle football before they were 12 years old. He looked at things like cognitive function and emotional regulation, including depression. And this is his second study looking at the effects of youth head impacts. And after hearing what Stern has to say, no matter how much you love tackle football, you're going to have to ask yourself whether it's time for your kid to stop playing. Dr. Robert Stern is with us in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back.
Also with us is Shira Springer, WBUR's sports and society reporter. Shira, hello.
Hello.
Okay, so Dr. Stern, first let me just ask you, your study finds a link of some kind between youth tackle football and impaired behavior and cognitive abilities later in life. How strong is this link?
What we found was that people who played youth football before age 12 had a twofold increased odds of having significantly elevated depression scores later on in life, threefold increased odds for having worse behavioral regulation problems, apathy, and what we call executive functioning. So that's a pretty big thing.
Well, it seems like a massive thing, honestly, if you ask me. But how does that compare to a control population that never played any kind of tackle football?
So the way we chose our outcome measures, they were based on a normative sample of healthy individuals. And we didn't just look at the, you know, where the scores were and, you know, over a big continuum. We had cutoffs of clinically meaningful problems. Mm-hmm. So it was above just the normal functioning compared to same age peers.
Okay, I see. So then the distinction here is, did you find that there were significant differences regardless of whether or not someone played football at any age versus a normative population?
Right. So, you know, there's no way for us to say that the folks who started playing at age 12 or older were fine. No, there were a lot of elevated scores in that group as well. It was really between those two groups, the difference was pretty striking.
So that's, again, before the age of 12.
That's right.
Shira, what's your first reaction to this? You've been covering this story for a long time.
Wow is the first reaction. I mean, it's deeply, deeply concerning when you hear, you know, the increase of impairment if you've played tackle football prior to the age of 12. And I also think it's a bit of a wake-up call for parents, because I think parents, when they talk about head injuries and issues with head injuries at the youth level and quite frankly at any level of football, they think about concussions. And really what this study was saying is the head impact doesn't have to rise to the level of concussion to, you know, create some sort of impairment later in life. So I think for parents who are out there saying, oh, my kid's okay, he wasn't concussed, it's like, hold on, wait a second. There are other bad outcomes even if your kid doesn't suffer from a concussion. And you need to watch the number of head impacts, the subconcussive head impacts that your kid is suffering from.
Yeah, to me, that's the big issue, is this exposure to all of these repetitive hits. Let me give you an example. There was a study that came out of Wake Forest last December where they had a bunch of youth football players and they put accelerometers in their helmets, a way to be able to measure the number of hits, the severity of the hits, etc. But they gave these kids MRI scans before and after one season of play. And they then got rid of anyone who had a concussion. And then they looked at the relationship between the total number of hits the kids got above a certain force and changes in the integrity of the white matter of their brain. Sadly, what they found was this very strong relationship. The more hits kids got, youth football, the greater the change in the structures of their brain over just one season of play.
Yeah, and I think, I hope, that the Wake Forest study and Dr. Stern's study wake up some parents and then also lead to some changes in policy, some changes in regulation at the youth football level. We have seen that happen with youth soccer. You know, the subconcussive impacts, some impacts from heading the ball. U.S. soccer looked at that and saw that they needed to make some rule changes. Now there are restrictions on when you can start heading a ball, how much you can start heading a ball between the ages of, I believe it's 13 and under, precisely because of the effect of these subconcussive hits on the brain. And so I think there's this growing awareness, and I hope that this wakes up youth football and they say, hey, we've got to do something about this. This is a real tipping point.
So, Dr. Stern, if we could just step backwards here for a second, because I want to apply, I'm just going to add a little skepticism here, because that's what we do in journalism and science as well. None of these are going to be unfamiliar, but correlation doesn't equal causation. You were looking at people who probably played, you know, 30, 40 years ago. So is it possible that, A, some of them just played longer and therefore came up with these outcomes in their 50s? Is it possible that safety and equipment is actually better now, so perhaps people should worry less? And can we say definitively it's because of the hits that they tested differently in middle age?
No, yes, yes, no, yes. So one really important thing is we statistically controlled for the number of years they played football.
Okay.
The sample was made up of people who only played up through high school, only played up through college, and then some pros as well. It didn't matter what level they played up to, and it didn't matter how many years they played.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't the total length that they were playing football.
It was that pre-12-year-old.
In this study, that's what we were focusing on, and that's what we found. Now, correlation does not equal causation. Absolutely not. No matter what, it's really hard to prove causation. And so until we have definitive answers, there's a choice. We either err on the side of safety or we keep going. Now, here's an interesting thing. There was a policy statement by the American Academy of Pediatrics that was published a couple of years ago, and it was a statement about youth tackle football. And in it, they review all of the literature about injuries, all types of injuries and problems associated with youth tackle football, from orthopedic injuries to heart problems to concussions. And even they brought up the possibility of later life problems with CTE. And after all that review, they have some bullets about recommendations. One of them said, we do not recommend stopping youth tackle football because it would change the very nature of the game.
Is it the American Academy of Pediatrics role to decide what the nature of youth tackle football should be? I mean,
it shouldn't help the health of the child be... Yeah. Preeminent?
But okay, but for a minute, they're saying that because a lot of people care about that.
Yeah.
Look, football is the most popular sport in this country.
Yeah.
And I think there are tons of people listening right now who would say, absolutely, it's not football without the tackle.
So, you know, I'm a scientist and I don't like to say policy should be changed, rules should be changed based on one study. You know, there are growing studies.
This is the second study you've done a lot.
Yeah. And you have the Wake Forest study out there. I mean, that seems pretty damning in many respects.
For me, right now, it's a parental decision. We have to step back and say, you know, we parents do really amazing things to protect our kids. And yet, we then drop them off in a playing field when they're 6, 7 years old and put a big plastic helmet and face mask on them and say, go at it. Hit your head over and over and over again. Forgetting that inside that head is the most precious organ we have, our brain.
Dr. Stern, so back in January 2015, you were on the show because you had done a study about the brains of former NFL players who had played before the age of 12. And I actually recall asking you, so are you saying that parents should not be letting their kids play tackle football before the age of 12. And I feel, are you getting close? You were a bit cautious in your answer last time, not wanting to tell parents how to parent. But are you getting closer to having an answer?
The science has indeed matured a lot. Where I am now is making sure that parents and everyone understands that kids benefit from taking part in youth sports. But am I at a point to say kids shouldn't be hitting their heads repeatedly until a certain age? Yeah, I'm there.
Now, I agree, obviously, with everything Dr. Stern is saying, but I'd introduce sort of the parents' perspective. And you think logic applies when it comes to parents in sports, but very often logic doesn't always apply. It's very hard, I think, sometimes for parents to take their kids out of youth sports for a variety of reasons. Maybe it's because the kid loves playing tackle football.
There's Let's talk about how we celebrate the sport in our culture and society.
Yes, and not only how we celebrate the sport in our society, but also I think another interesting aspect of this whole thing is you looked at players in midlife, average age 51. So they were in that youth category a long time ago. And since then, you've had this tremendous professionalization, as people like to say, of youth sports to the point where there are many more games, many more practices. Kids are on many more teams. And so the number of hits, the number of subconcussive hits, the number of concussions, all of that is rising in the culture in which we celebrate and participation in sports.
I mean, you've already brought up soccer. So just to be clear, we're not just talking about, in terms of the broader picture, not just talking about football.
Yes,
soccer, hockey,
lacrosse, all of the sports that are contact sports and expose your brain to hits.
I think football probably has the most of that type of hit across all the different ages. So for me, the answer is delay it as much as possible.
So to when,
to
though?
To wait. Yeah. There's no magic number. We know one thing, that the more exposure overall, the worse the consequences later on. So if you can delay it, and if you can delay it past these critical periods of neurodevelopmental maturation, that makes sense. It just makes logical sense.
Shira, I have a question for you, because it seems like a really tough call for people who love football because, I mean, 12, then we're in 13, 14, they're in high school by that time.
And also, it's harder to pull, I think, a 15 or 16-year-old out of football than it is to perhaps put restrictions on a kid who's younger.
How would it change the sport? Both, you know, for young people who want to go on and play in college, let alone professionally, if, say, they were told, you got to delay learning how to play tackle football until you're a freshman in high school or sophomore. I mean, is that realistic at all? I mean, I don't think
it's realistic. I mean, especially, I mean, we're talking here in Boston, but I can't imagine, like, in Texas, somebody getting away with saying, you can't play tackle football until you reach high school age. I mean, that's sort of, they see it as a rite of passage, you know, in many places to have your son play football.
So the NFL now sponsors flag football, and there's more and more leagues of youth flag football. That's probably going to gain more traction.
It will never replace youth tackle football in some regions of the country. It's just the fact.
You have to remember our own Tom Brady didn't start playing until high school.
But, you know, there are only so many Tom Bradys. He's the exception to the rule
and
in so many
won't
ways.
And talk about how many concussions he's had.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I just wonder, though, what it's going to take for some parents to recognize the dangers of these subconcussive hits. It just doesn't connect with some parents, and I don't know when the tipping point for them is. And I think now, I you know, most reports say the number of kids playing football between 6 and 12 years old is about 1.2 million. It's hovered around that number. I wonder if we're not due for a precipitous decline for another decade. I don't know what you think.
Who knows? It's hard to look into a crystal ball about what the numbers are going to be. I can tell you I freak out when I look into a crystal ball about how many people might start showing problems as the years go forward. And the reason for that is that tackle football as we know it didn't really start until the 1950s when those big helmets with face masks started to be used routinely. And then youth tackle football didn't really start until the late 60s and early 70s when Pop Warner became more of a national thing. So the people who started playing tackle football as kids, they are only in their late 50s and early 60s.
Right now.
They're the ones who started hitting their heads over and over again. And these problems that we study, like CTE, are diseases of aging. I'm afraid of the increase in numbers as we move forward over the next decade or so.
Well, Dr. Robert Stern is Director of Clinical Research at Boston University's Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy Center. Dr. Stern, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And Shira Springer, WBUR sports and society reporter. Shira, thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And we did reach out to Pop Warner Little Scholars, one of the largest youth football programs in the world, and they just now sent us a statement saying the participants in this study played youth football 40 years ago. Youth football has evolved significantly since that time period, and major changes in Pop Warner have implemented and revolutionized the sport, making it safer and better than ever before. The statement goes on to say it's been suggested that selection bias calls into question the conclusions of the study. Still, our medical advisory committee will review it and compare it against the number of recent studies that contradict these findings. So that's a statement from Pop Warner Football. We know a lot of you have your kids playing football, so let us know what you think about it. Send us a tweet at Radio Boston or comment at radioboston.org. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.